The lectionary today lifts up first another reading from the Gospel of Matthew, which Paul will share from chapter 5, the teaching of Jesus to his disciples then, and of course to us disciples now. Listen for a word from the Lord.
You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot. You are the light of the world. A town built on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven. Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For truly I tell you, until heaven and earth disappear, not the smallest letter, not the least stroke of a pen will by any means disappear from the law until the least of these commands have been accomplished. Therefore, anyone who sets aside one of these commands and teaches others accordingly will be called the least in heaven. For I tell you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God. And then, in parallel, the lectionary once again takes us to 1 Corinthians, Paul's shared words of wisdom with the Christians in Corinth. Now the lectionary has us in the second chapter of that book. And today we take a small bite, as it were, the first five verses, as Paul continues to unpack the themes of the gospel as he understands them. Says the apostle, "When I came to you, brothers and sisters, I did not come to you proclaiming the mystery of God in lofty words of wisdom or fancy philosophy. No, I decided to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. I came to you in weakness. I came to you in fear and in much trembling. My speech and my teaching and proclamation, they were not with plausible words of wisdom and sophistication. No, they were with a demonstration of the Spirit, capital S. God's Spirit and God's power, so that your faith might rest not on human wisdom or good preaching or cleverness, but so that your faith would rest only on the power of God." This too, saints, is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. If you read my emails on Friday that go out, you already know that for me, for the Apostle Paul to say something like, "I did not come to you in lofty words of wisdom, in highfalutin speech, or with great oratory," for him to say that is something like Miss America, after a year of representing her crown, concluding that outward beauty can be vain. And what really matters is the heart. Yeah, easy for her to say, right? Easy for Paul to say. Understand, Paul, the first century Jew, educated in the best schools, first of his class among the Pharisees, who were actually by design a learned group of Jews, students of God's ancient law who knew the language and its finesse and had the capacity to, to think and moralize and teach that same law. Paul was by all accounts articulate. The book of Acts has him often in public spheres offering words before the gathered crowd or even by the end of his ministry in front of Roman judiciary hearings. The man could talk. The man was smart. But, by the time he writes to the Christians in Corinth, you see, I think he's lived enough of his life, and more to the point, followed Jesus far enough into the world, practiced the ministry of an apostle, one who has sent to the far regions of places to share the good news and build up a new community in Jesus Christ. Paul has done enough of that by now to know that no matter how smart you are, no matter how articulate you may be, no matter the degrees on your wall in your office, it all comes to a limit. Paul has reached the limits of his own expertise and intelligence, and he has seen things now. He has seen God's power eclipse his own ability. I mean, if you don't believe me, read the book of Acts. What a rough and tumble story. Half of it is just about Paul and those around him as he feels himself called to go to place and to call people to faith and hope and love in Jesus Christ and to build up those communities. Sometimes it's met with welcome and gladness. Often it's met with resistance and sabotage and politics and power. Paul gets beaten up. He gets thrown out of communities. At one point, he takes a trip across the Mediterranean Sea and they shipwreck. I mean, Paul has been to the limits for this faith. And he's come to understand that while education is a gift and intelligence surely comes from God, they have their limits. The truth of this gospel is not its cleverness. It doesn't rest on those who proclaim it with fancy words or great education. It is true because God has made it true. It has power not because of the church, but because of God. So he says, I didn't come to you with a fancy sermon. I didn't polish up every word. I didn't think through every strategy with some long-range plan. I just came to you and those with me, and we simply proclaimed the good news of Jesus, his teaching, his death, his resurrection, and all that that might mean for new life. Paul took a back seat to God, and he reminds the Corinthians that their belief, their hope, their love, it's not built on Paul's cleverness or strategy or design. No, it's built on God, the only one whose word lasts the test of time. So you see, I think it's true for us as well, saints. Our knowledge of God's stunning love begins precisely where our own strength gives out. Whether we like it or not, the truth is usually this. We don't get a full taste of God's mercy until we need it. We can sit in Sunday school and youth group and Bible study and growing up in the church, and it's all good. I'm not a cynic. But frankly, until you come to the edge, until you walk the tightrope of life, until you stand at the cliff of some crisis or experience and look down and realize how fragile and precious life and faith and hope can be, it's usually only then that the power and strength of God becomes clear, not just in the brain, but in the heart and in the soul. If one never hits one's limits, there is a sense in which one will never really know God. That's the strange mystery of this faith. That it's through our weaknesses we meet God's power. It's through our limitations that we come to see just how limitless God is. It's in our humility. Not humiliation, but humility. a right sense of ourselves and our capacities. Only then are we positioned to see how beautiful and generous and merciful God turns out to be. Otherwise, we tend to credit ourselves. Otherwise, we tend to rest on our own laurels. Otherwise, we tend to trust that our strength and our capacity and our resume will see us through. It's not those things are fake or meaningless. It's just that they all reach their limit. Some way, somehow, all of us come to the end of our own strength. The good news is, though, it's in those spaces we meet God afresh. And the meaning and purpose of Jesus Christ, who comes to us and shows us God's power and strength and glory, how? By dying on a cross. By giving up his life, by choosing weakness and defeat as the ultimate statement of what God's power and grace looks like. Only at our bottom are we likely to see just how great and good God is. I want to share with you an experience that drove this home for me. Some of you have heard me tell this story, but I don't think I've told it in mass. It's timely because it was almost exactly a year ago that Mark Brown and I took a group of our youth from this church to Columbus, Georgia. First Presbyterian Church in Columbus hosted a Presbytery youth event, and we brought a group of our kids there, and the day's activities included, among other things, whitewater rafting on that section of the Chattahoochee in Columbus that some of you know has some rafting capabilities, and guides will take you down that river. Now, first of all, I want to say to you that it was worth the price of admission to see Mark Brown and Ralph Hawkins in a wetsuit. He looked better than I did, and that's not saying much. But secondly, a year ago today means February. Chattahoochee, river, cold. It's actually a nice day outside. But when the leaders of that effort, the Presbytery leaders, told us that we were still going to go whitewater rafting, I wondered. We got down to the river, all of us. There were 50 or 60 kids in total, including ours from this church. And we put on our wetsuits and our life jackets, and they gave us paddles. And because the river was running either high or low, I can't remember, they just confined us to a certain section right downtown at that dock where we would simply go up and traverse the rapids, get out, go up, do it again, just around and around in a cyclical fashion. I went 5 times without going in the water. And on that 5th time when I got out of the boat, having not gone in the drink, I thought to myself, thanks be to God. I did not want to go in that river today when it's this cold. And then the call came, let's go one more time. So we went one more time. Half of our Northminster group was in one boat, the other half was in the other. We pushed out from shore, I in the back, the guide right behind me, and 6 or 7 youth in front of me. And we no more went through that first rapids. And the next thing I knew, I was underwater. I mean, it happens like that. Now listen, I was a Boy Scout. I'm a decent swimmer. I grew up in a river. It's fine. I know what to do. But you know what happened in February? The first thing I recognized was I couldn't breathe. Not just because I was underwater. Even when I came back out of the water and my head broke the surface, I went to take a breath. I couldn't do it. I literally could not breathe. My whole body had tightened up because of the cold, cold water, and I could not catch my breath. Now again, Boy Scout, grew up on the water, water skiing, camping, all that. I knew what to do. It's okay, first find the boat. So I tried to turn around, couldn't see the boat. Then I thought, okay, you need to get to the shore. So I began making a mental plan in my mind how I was going to paddle and push myself out of the middle of the river over to the shore. I didn't get too far, though, before I began to appreciate that was going to be a long, long journey because I couldn't breathe. I could not catch my breath. I turned around a little bit, still looking in desperation for our raft and our young strapping guide. Couldn't find him. What I did find, though, was Ben Shuford. Ben's not here today, so I'll pick on him. I looked over and I saw Ben's face, and it was clear to me he couldn't breathe either. He was white as a ghost, and he looked panicked. And I'm not picking on him, because I was beginning to get panicked too. It was cold, the river was moving fast, I couldn't see any orienting features. I was beginning to worry. So I pushed myself over to Ben, and what did he do? God bless him. Piled on top of me. The shepherd giving his life for the sheep, I thought to myself. And the next thing I knew, I was under the water again. Trying to hold Ben and me up now. My gosh. And I tell you, saints, all kidding aside, at that point, I was beginning to worry. I was beginning to think to myself, this is how things end badly. This is how, in a matter of seconds, you go from having fun to really possible calamity. I was beginning to think in terms of life or death. We continued to float down the river. Ben continued to grab onto me for dear life. I continued to look around for a guide or a raft or somebody. Finally, after what seemed like a year and a half, somebody who worked for the rafting company was in a kayak and he had gotten over to where we were. And he was able to grab Ben and get him off of me. The raft we had been in finally came up behind me and the guy put his oar out, but I couldn't reach it. There was this moment of futility where I kept trying to grasp the end of the oar. I couldn't do it. I couldn't keep a grip. By this time, I was starting to feel a little funny. I still hadn't really caught my breath. So after they got Ben out of the water, and after the raft kind of came around in front of me to where I was, I finally was able to grab the rope on the side of our boat. And I looked up and I saw before me the face of our 20-something young guide who was probably half my weight and half my age. To be clear, a young, fit guy, but not 280 pounds, slightly pudgy and overweight, and 6'5". I couldn't talk. I couldn't say a thing, truly. Couldn't speak. Still really wasn't breathing well. But I must have had the look, because God's truth, that guy reached over all the way out of the boat and down about 18 inches to where I was in the water. He grabbed my life preserver on the shoulders. And the next thing I knew, I was lying on my back in that boat looking at the sky. And I thought to myself, I've just been saved. This is what it feels like. It was an unbelievable experience to be totally and completely and literally at the end of one's rope and to be rescued by someone else's strength. Now look, I don't want to overplay it. Was my life really on the line? Probably not. Probably things were always going to be okay. But I tell you what, it was a powerful feeling to be saved, to be pulled up out of those waters and dragged to a place of safety. I can still feel what that felt like, and I still reflect on it. For the gift of what it means spiritually to come to the end of your rope, to surrender our need for control and comfort and assurance, and to give ourselves over to God, whose strength begins where ours ends. That's what Paul has discovered, you see. I didn't come to you with fancy-schmancy sermons and a lot of philosophy. I could have. I'm a smart guy. I can talk like the rest of them, Paul says, but that's not what saves us. It's the goodness of God. And so he says, let the church be the kind of community where we gather, not in our sophistication, not in our social status, not in our resumes. Those things have their place, but it's not what binds us together. Let your faith rest on God's power, not on the personality of the preacher, not on the architecture of the building, not even on family legacy in a place, though that can be a blessing. Let it rest solely on God's power. So, Let the church be, on the one hand, the kind of place where we spur each other on to excellence, where we push each other to grow, where we challenge each other to have courage and be strong, absolutely. But let Christ's church also be the kind of place where weakness is acknowledged, where no one pretends we are anything other than who we are, human beings, at once capable and frail, at once beautiful and fragile, at once strong, but soon enough weak. Somehow the church is called to live its life in both those places, to lean in, to love, to serve, to do, to accomplish, to achieve, to bear witness, but also to be the kind of community where we simply admit what is already true. We need God. And frankly, we need each other. Lest any of us, as my dad used to say, get a little too big for our spiritual britches. Right? We need each other to ground ourselves both in strength but also in humility. I came to you, says Paul, in spirit and in God's power, so that your faith would rest not on me, but on God who saves. Hallelujah and amen.